So last night, Padmavajra in his talk, he gave a commentary on Banta's poem Advent and said that every time he does a mythic context retreat, the poem Advent comes into his mind. So as Padmavajra's just said, I only joined the ordination team last year and I haven't done the mythic context retreat as part of the team yet, so I can't call upon my own recurring image in the same kind of way. But nevertheless, when I did find out that I'd be speaking on the retreat and went away and gave it some space, something did just come into mind, a particular image. And in my case, the image wasn't a poem, it was a memory. And it was actually a memory of the pilgrimage to Yorkshire with Padmavajra that Padmavajra's just mentioned. So I'm going to be speaking about that a little bit and sharing a memory from that particular tour. So by happy coincidence, before we went on that pilgrimage to Yorkshire, I was reading through Bhante's travel letters, so Through Buddhist Eyes, the collection of his travel letters. And in one of them from the late 1980s, he actually described a visit that he'd made to Yorkshire and the various places that he went in the county. So for anybody that doesn't know, by the way, Yorkshire is a county in the north of England. And it's sometimes referred to as God's own country. And I think probably on the grounds of it being quite spectacular in terms of the variation in its landscape and that kind of thing. But Bhante described this trip and how he went to Hull, as we did, and visited a new, nice but rather expensive Indian restaurant. And he went to Beverley, which is a small market town just north of Hull. Went over the Humber Bridge, which had just opened at that particular time. You can tell I like Hull and the surrounding area. But he also went to Rivo Abbey, which is an old ruined monastery in North Yorkshire. So seeing this in the travel letters, me and Padmavajra decided to, in a way, trace Bhante's steps, although going to other places as well on the same tour. But I want to talk to you in particular about our visit to Rivo Abbey. So as I said, Rivo Abbey is in North Yorkshire, and it's set in the North Yorkshire moors, a very beautiful landscape. And it's not alone in terms of being a ruined monastery in that particular area. There are many of them. But Rivo is probably the finest example. So it's an old Cistercian monastery, I think built in the 10th century, possibly the 11th century, something like that. And obviously now it's a ruin, so it was dissolved centuries ago and just left to rot, basically. So many of the old walls are now either just foundations or very small. I mean, there are still some examples of the quite grand arches of the monastery, and actually some sections of wall, particularly in the main tower, are still quite intact and interspersed with kind of grass areas now that you can walk around. Padmavajra and I, we entered into the monastery and we were just wandering around, and I think independently of each other, felt this sense of sadness and loss that, you know, a once thriving spiritual community had very quickly been dissolved and wiped out, and this once grand building had been left to rot and become a ruin. And eventually, as we walked through the complex, we came to the old cloister. So the cloister would have been the walkway that the monks could have circumambulated, much like we do outside in the stupa, but a covered area with presumably grand arches and different stone carvings, none of which is there anymore. But the outskirts of the walkway is there, and the patch of grass and garden in the centre is still there. And when we got to this point, Padmavajra took a book out of his rucksack and he started to read aloud from this book. And there weren't very many other people around. I seem to remember a couple of children running and jumping up on the stones, and to them we were probably just obstacles in whatever game they were playing. And there were some other adults dotted around here and there, reading the information boards and learning about the Abbey. But really we were there as pilgrims. I don't think anybody could see that, but we definitely felt we were there as pilgrims. Because the book that Padmavajra started to read from was a text by Alred of Rivo called Spiritual Friendship. So Alred of Rivo was the abbot at Rivo Abbey in the middle of the 12th century. And he wrote various things, but I think the most famous piece is this text on spiritual friendship. So Padmavajra started to read a particular section, and much to my delight, it actually described a scene that presumably took place in the cloister. So I'm going to read you now the extract, or part of the extract that Padmavajra read on that day. So this is Alred talking to some of his disciples about spiritual friendship, and he says, "The day before yesterday, I was walking around the monastery with the brothers sitting in a most loving circle. I marvelled at the leaves, blossoms and fruits of each single tree, as if I were in the fragrant bowers of paradise. Finding not one soul whom I did not love, and I was sure not one soul by whom I was not loved, I was filled with a joy that surpassed all the delights of the world. Indeed, as I felt my spirit flowing into them all, and the affection of all coursing through me, I could say with the prophet, 'See how good and how pleasant it is for brethren to live in unity.'" So hearing Padmavajra read that particular passage, just found myself very deeply moved on that particular occasion. And just reflecting in the past week or so about that, I think there were three things that I had a strong response to, three things about that particular reading that I was responding to, that I was moved by. So I think the first, I mean, it's just the word monastery. Hearing the word monastery, there's just some kind of response, some kind of fascination, because it immediately evokes the archetype of the monk. So those words, monk and monastery, they both come from the Greek word monos, which translates as alone. So in the archetype of the monk, I really see this figure who is alone, who's gone forth, if you like, from the world, has gone forth to live a spiritual life, a holy life, and completely dedicated to that, willing to give up the world in order to pursue that. So I find that a deeply compelling archetype. And I was struck yesterday in Padmavajra's talk about the way he described Bhante in India in those early years, himself being a wanderer, somebody who'd gone forth. Padmavajra described the intensity of his devotion, and the way he would walk for miles in that Indian summer heat. So that's one of the archetypes that's contained in that particular extract that moves me. I think the other is the whole notion of spiritual community. So Alred describing the scene of the monks sat together in a most loving circle. So it's not just that as individuals they've committed their lives to the pursuit of truth, the living of a religious life. They also come together as a community, in harmony with each other. And there's that lovely description that Alred has of the affection, the mutual affection that passes between them, the brotherhood, the spiritual friendship, to take the title of the text. But also there's another element, I think, to that. So this sense of community, this sense of friendship, but also an element of what we would call, I guess, the vertical dimension of spiritual friendship. So Alred is looking out on the monks in the cloister, I'm imagining in a fatherly kind of way. So he's the abbot, they're his disciples, they would see him as the father, they would be the sons. So definitely a sense, hearing that passage, of this atmosphere of spiritual friendship and the dynamics within that of discipleship, of love, of respect, of reverence, and of admiration. I think the third thing in that extract that I respond to is that which Alred seems to be alluding to without actually naming, or putting into words, at least not a specific word and something that's reducible to a particular concept. So it's almost as if there's something intangible, something indefinable in that particular passage that's been evoked in that particular passage. So I get the sense that Alred is looking out on the monks and he's not just seeing individuals, and he's looking out and he's not just seeing a community. It's almost as if he's seeing something beyond the individuals and beyond the community, yet it's manifesting among them and flowing between them. So there's that lovely line about how he marvels at the leaves, blossoms and fruits of each single tree as if he's in the fragrant bowers of paradise. And I don't know if he's being literal there or if he's being metaphorical, so perhaps there were trees and flowers in the cloister at that time. But it's almost as if he's seeing the individual people and seeing their qualities, their unique qualities. And that produces this effect of something sweet and fragrant, as if he feels himself to be in the paradise. So it's as if he's seeing something more than just people sat together. There's also the way he describes his own experience of that. He says that he feels a joy that surpassed all the delights of the world. So again, this sense that there is something otherworldly going on for him in that particular experience. And then lastly, that the way he describes his spirit flowing into them and their affection coursing into him. It's almost with that that he's evoking something that is beyond self and other. He feels so strongly, imaginatively identifying so strongly with these other men that it's as if that distinction between himself and others is breaking down to some extent. And then he talks in terms of this great unity. So I do get the sense of something really quite profound taking place. At least I can imagine it. Something mysterious, something out of the ordinary, something strange. Padmavajra used the word strange last night. Something intangible, something indefinable. And so much so that only poetry can express it, only the images that Alred uses can express it. So hearing Padmavajra read that passage at Revo Abbey, like I say, I was deeply moved by that. But it wasn't just the content of the reading, it wasn't just the content of that passage that was moving me. I think it was also a sense that these archetypes that are being evoked in that particular passage by Alred, I had a sense that actually they were alive in that particular moment that we were stood there and Padmavajra was reading to me. So that archetype of the monk, okay, so Padmavajra and myself are not monks, but we are members of a religious order. We have gone forth from a worldly life and committed ourselves to live in a spiritual life. We're Dharmacharis. We've answered that call to the higher life. So as much as the reading was evoking this archetype of the monk, I could also sense that, well, we're like that. you know, just to an extent, we're living out this particular myth. And also, we're part of a spiritual community as well. So we're both disciples of Bhante, and the order is a broader collection of the disciples of Bhante. So there's a sense of us being there as part of this broader spiritual community, imagining this other historical spiritual community. And just like I said with Alred in the reading, there's this sense of verticality and a master and his disciples. I did get the sense of, as well, being with Padmavajra, that that dynamic was there for us too. So we're spiritual friends, but Padmavajra is also my private preceptor. It was him who ordained me. I really look up to Padmavajra and respect him, and I see him as my principal teacher. I probably learned more about the Dharma through my friendship with Padmavajra than I have from any other source. So a lot of respect and admiration for him for that. And on top of all that, he's also extremely kind, extremely generous. So the fact that he was reading this passage about Alred and his disciples, and we were there together with that particular dynamic between us, again, it just added to the particular weight of that experience. And because of that, because of this sort of strange situation of evoking a scene and living it out at the same time, there's just something deeply mysterious as well about that whole moment, about that whole experience. It was almost as if I was experiencing things on two different levels. So there was this, if you like, archetypal level, the level of the imagination and the mythic dimension being evoked through the reading and being there in that particular space, in that particular time. But also, yeah, very much aware that these archetypes were being embodied. So there was a kind of physical reality, a historical reality to this experience as well. Yeah, so it was as if I was, or we were evoking these timeless archetypes, these timeless myths, and somehow embodying it and living it out within time and space as well. So I do wonder if perhaps there's something of that going on for us now. So just sitting here in the shrine room and you all listening to me talk, can we see this particular experience, this particular moment, mythically? So I'm communicating this particular memory to you all. I'm evoking these archetypes of the spiritual aspirant, evoking the archetype of the spiritual community, and evoking Alred's description of what seems to be a kind of self-transcending love. And I'm sure that you're all, to some extent, responding to those different archetypes. I'm sure that you've all felt yourselves the call to live a spiritual life. You wouldn't be here, obviously, if you hadn't. So there'll be something in you that's potentially been moved by me evoking the archetype of the spiritual aspirant. Also, I'm sure you've all experienced the magic of spiritual community. Again, I don't think you'd be here if you hadn't have experienced that. You wouldn't have asked to join the order because you wouldn't have had a sense that actually this spiritual community is something really special and really profound. And you're probably all aware of the whole mystery of all that, and I imagine find it difficult to communicate something of that. So communicating to people why you feel moved to live a spiritual life, why you feel moved to join and move into and participate in this spiritual community. So hopefully you can all relate to this particular memory and what I'm evoking. And I hope you can all relate to this passage in Alred's text and why it felt so significant to be standing there in the ruins of Rivo Abbey evoking Alred and the monks of the abbey. So perhaps just sitting here now in the shrine room, we can have a sense of existing, at least to some extent, on different levels. So physically, obviously we're here, we can feel that, we can see each other and all the rest of it with our senses. But imaginatively, perhaps we're also partly in the 12th century, in Rivo Abbey, at its height, with our red, with those monks. Perhaps there's something of that going on too. Perhaps we can get a sense of these archetypes outside of space and time, or that transcend space and time, and see that actually we're living that out to some extent. We're all here together as spiritual aspirants, forming a spiritual community. I mean, we could say that this retreat is the expression, or Padmaloka as well, is the expression or the manifestation of those archetypes, of those timeless archetypes within space and time. So where does that desire to live a spiritual life come from? And where does the desire to form a spiritual community come from? Who knows? It's a mystery. The essence of that is a mystery. And yet, somehow here it is. Somehow here it is manifesting amongst us and between us. So perhaps it's as if we can feel as if we are existing on different levels, just sitting here in the shrine room, listening to a Dharma talk. I mean, often that's not the case, is it? So speaking personally, I often experience myself just on the kind of physical level, just on the level of the physical senses, in the realm of the physical senses. But I'm sure that that's not all that's happening. I'm sure that that's not all that's going on. And Bhante gave a brilliant lecture on this theme as part of the series on the Vimlakirti Nadesha back in the late 1970s. So a lecture called History versus Myth in Man's Quest for Meaning. And in the lecture, he starts off by describing an exhibition of Asian Buddhist art that was put on as part of the celebrations for the 2500th anniversary of the Buddha's enlightenment in 1956 in New Delhi. And at this particular exhibition, he was really struck by the Chinese section of the exhibition, and again in particular by a mural painting of Vimlakirti meeting Manjushri. So he describes that meeting between Vimlakirti and Manjushri as being a confrontation. He describes it in terms of history confronting myth. So history versus myth is in the title. So he speaks of, on the one hand, how in the Vimlakirti Nidesha you have Vimlakirti, who is the Bodhisattva assuming the appearance of a layperson. And Vimlakirti is an old man. He's subject to the ravages of time. He's subject to aging, has greying hair, wispy beard, wrinkled skin. And Vimlakirti lives in a particular place, and he has a personal identity. So he's living in this mercantile city. He's involved in some kind of business himself. He has a wife, he has children. So he definitely has a historical personality. He has a historical existence that is concrete and tangible. So Bhante says that Vimlakirti represents historical reality. And then he contrasts that with Manjushri. So Manjushri, by comparison, is eternally young. He's not subject to time at all. He's not bound by space, although he manifests in time and space. He has no mundane identity, no historical existence. So his is a what Bhante describes as a transcendental existence, or even a glorified existence. So he represents, as Bhante puts it, archetypal reality. He represents myth. So the two of them together representing history, historical reality, and myth, or archetypal reality, and having this kind of confrontation. So Bhante goes on to say that most of the time we think that we just exist in the realm of that is represented there by Vimalakirti. So most of the time we experience ourselves as being historical beings, as having a historical sort of existence. But he says that if we want to find meaning in our lives, then we have to try to break out of that. We have to emancipate ourselves from a merely historical existence. So he says that we need to discover, through our exploration of myth and that whole area, we need to discover our spiritual reality, our archetypal being. And he says that that way of being, that spiritual being, that archetypal being, isn't constrained at all by time, isn't constrained by space, isn't constrained by causality. So I'm just going to read you a short passage from the lecture. So Bhante says, on one level, we belong to the realm of historical reality. But on another, we belong to the realm of spiritual reality. The Mahayana scriptures reveal this world to us. So does myth. So does poetry. And they reveal it to us not as something external to ourselves, but as our own world, as a world in which we ourselves actually live, usually without knowing it. So then, just in case people get the wrong end of the stick, if people get the wrong idea, and start to take that too literally, he goes on to say, although we can make the transition to the realm of archetypal reality, this does not mean that we leave the realm of historical reality behind. We cannot, must not, opt for myth and discard history. We need both, because we exist in both realms. We exist in them both all the time, whether or not we are aware of it. And of course, a lot of the time, we are not aware of it. And just carrying on, because it gets better and better. He says, there's no question, therefore, of our literally passing from one realm to the other. They do not even exist side by side. In the mural painting, Vimalakirti and Manjushri confront one another in a vigorous encounter. This is history versus myth. And what we have to do is bring them together. There has to be a sort of marriage between Vimalakirti and Manjushri. We have to realize that Vimalakirti is Manjushri, and Manjushri is Vimalakirti. Time is eternity. Eternity is time. Rupa, form, is shunyata, emptiness. Shunyata is rupa. If we can realize that, then history and myth will have played their part in humanity's quest for meaning. And that quest for meaning, our quest for ourselves, will be complete. So I just find that an extraordinary passage. And hopefully it throws some light on what I've been trying to communicate about that experience at Revo Abbey. So that experience of simultaneously being aware of being moved, being compelled by these archetypes, these timeless images of the monk and of the spiritual community, and at the same time being aware of, if you like, the historical reality, the fact of being in a particular time, a particular space, where those archetypes, those timeless archetypes, are manifesting in the midst of my own life. And of course, the whole mystery of that process and what's really going on there. And as well, maybe that passage can help to shed light on your own responses to what I'm saying now. So it might be that you are having a sense of these timeless archetypes and can see that actually they're in the midst of your own experience too, the fact that you're practicing the Dharma, living a spiritual life, being here on retreat as part of a spiritual community. It's as if there's something more than that going on at the same time in these two different levels. And even if you're not having that response to what I'm saying, which is fine, maybe there's some flavour of that on the retreat at the moment. Maybe you're getting some sense of that as we're going through the retreat, as we're exploring the mythic context, as we're doing the going for refuge and prostration practice. Or even if not on the retreat, just generally in the midst of your Dharma life and in life generally. So maybe some glimpse, some glimmer of that experience of existing on these two, seemingly two different kind of levels, the historical and the archetypal. Not that they literally exist side by side and that we can literally move from one into the other. So as Bhante says, our task, the task of our Dharma life is to become more conscious of all of this. To, as he puts it, marry the historical with the archetypal in our lives. Marry those two aspects of our experience together. Another way of putting it would be to say to integrate them in our lives. So I've been reflecting that the going for refuge and prostration practice, which is really the main practice of our retreat, the main focus of our retreat, it's helping us all to do this, I think. It's helping to bring that marriage between the historical and the archetypal into being. So it's bringing those seemingly different aspects of ourselves together. And I think it's doing that in two ways. So the first way is the image of the refuge tree itself is bringing together the archetypal and the historical. Padmavajra's already alluded to this in those sessions in the morning. So with the refuge tree, we've got a vision of enlightenment that includes both of those aspects. So it doesn't reduce enlightenment to something that's merely historical, and it doesn't project it outwards into something that is completely inaccessible to us. Somehow it brings those two dimensions together. So the refuge tree can help us to get a sense of what enlightenment, what going for refuge actually looks like, as manifested in time and space. So we have the great teachers and the arhats that are demonstrating that. And at the same time, it's a representation of enlightenment that is completely beyond those categories of time and space. So we have the archetypal Buddhas and Bodhisattvas that are not in any way limited to a particular form, in a particular time, in a particular space. And then, of course, at the very centre of the refuge tree, we have the Buddha Shakyamuni. And the Buddha Shakyamuni himself embodies those two different aspects. So all of the figures are coming out of the Buddha Shakyamuni, whether they are the historical figures or whether they're the archetypal figures on the refuge tree. They're all coming out of him. He is both at the same time. So Shakyamuni is the embodiment of the enlightenment that is not limited by space and time or any other conceptual category. The Buddha Shakyamuni is, as Padmavajra was saying last night, an unfathomable mystery to us. And yet, the Buddha communicated enlightenment. There was a manifestation in space and time in the communication to the disciples, to the arhats that we see on the refuge tree. And there's something of the Buddha's enlightenment that continually flows through space and time and is continually unfolding and is transmitted somehow by the great teachers, the historical figures on the refuge tree. And it's still unfolding. And we ourselves can have a connection to Shakyamuni and to the Buddha's enlightenment through these different figures and through our visualization of them. So the image itself then is bringing together, is marrying history and myth. But I think that the practice also is helping us to see those dynamics in our own being, in our own existence. So it occurs to me that we enter the going for refuge and prostration practice as a historical personality. At least that's how it feels to me. You know, I sit down and I very much feel an embodied human being, bound by time and space, defiled by various kleshas, defined and shaped by my karma and its effects. But then as we go into the practice, we enter into the deep blue space. And we're not limited by our historical personality at that particular point. So as we enter into that whole realm of the refuge tree, we can change. So we're not bound by our karma. It doesn't limit us, it doesn't fix us. We enter into a space where we can change, where we can go for refuge, where we can fulfill our deepest potential, where we can complete our quest for meaning. So we enter into that realm and we prostrate, we surrender, we open up, and that brilliant white light pours down upon us and it completely purifies us, so we become completely free of all limitations, of all constraints. So entering very fully into that archetypal realm. And then of course the light returns, the refuges dissolve, and we're sat here in the shrine room. We're back in the physical senses, in the physical realm, in the realm of historical reality. But we've changed. So we have modified through that experience. So it's as if we go from the historical realm into the archetypal realm and back again. But all the time something is changing as we're going between these seemingly two different realms. And we just keep doing that. We keep doing that, going from one into the other and back and back and back. And perhaps over time, in doing that, in practicing in that kind of way, perhaps those two, seemingly two different realms, start, as Bhante describes, to come together, be married together in our experience, to become integrated. So more and more I'm starting to think of the going for refuge and prostration practice in these terms, as an integration practice. But in saying that, I don't mean that in the sense of a preliminary practice whereby we're integrating so that we can then move on to higher teachings, bigger and better things. I mean it more in the sense of a kind of profound integration or a perfect integration. It seems possible through this type of practice. So it would be an integration that would be the marriage, ultimate marriage of history and myth, an integration into that great drama of cosmic enlightenment, integration into that great unfolding of the cosmic going for refuge that Padmavajra evoked this morning, and said that, as Bhante said, it's the key to the mystery of existence itself. So the practice seems to be guiding us towards that, guiding us towards an insight into what that really means, what that really looks like. And perhaps, just to finish off, maybe there was at least a sense of that, at least a reflection of that, in Alred's experience, going right back to Revo Abbey and the passage that I read. Maybe there was a glimpse of that kind of profound sense of integration, different realms coming together, as he was describing that scene at Revo Abbey. So don't know, can't prove that. Don't know what Alred's exact experience was, but perhaps there was something of a reflection in that, as he looked out in the cloister and saw the brothers and felt that flowing, selfless love between him and them. Perhaps it shed some light on why he chose to quote the prophet in saying, "See how good and how pleasant it is for the brethren to live in unity." So it seems to be suggesting a profound type of unity, not just people sat together, like I say, but something much deeper, something much more profound. So he uses the word unity, and I've been talking in terms of integration, but I don't think either of them quite satisfactorily capture what Bhante is trying to evoke in terms of the marriage of the marriage of history and myth. And I was trying to think what a better word would be for that. And I think the best word I could come up with was to use the words of one of the great masters that sits on the refuge tree. So use the language of the great Japanese Soto Zen master Dogen. So he talked about the depths of reality in terms of intimacy. So again, you can see the parallel with unity, integration, but he spoke in terms of intimacy, which seems to capture something of the warmth and the flow of love that Alred was evoking there. So I'm going to finish with a quote from Dogen that hopefully ties some of the threads together. And it's him defining what he means when he talks of intimacy. So Dogen says, "Intimacy means close and inseparable. There is no gap. Intimacy means the Buddhas embrace everything. You embrace everything. And I embrace everything. Practice includes all. A generation includes all. And intimacy includes all. You should clearly study this. Indeed, intimacy comes forth at the place where the person is, at the moment when understanding takes place. Right now is the very moment when you are intimate with yourself, intimate with others. You are intimate with Buddhas and intimate with other beings. This being so, intimacy renews intimacy. Because the teaching of practice enlightenment is the way of Buddhas, it is intimacy that penetrates Buddhas. Thus, intimacy penetrates intimacy."